don't think so. I don't know. All right.
Morning, Your Honors.
Is it pronounced Robert?
It is pronounced Robert.
All right, Mr. Robert.
Please, the court. My name is Al Robert. I am counsel for Dr. Byram Zamanian, who is the appellant in this matter. We are here before this court seeking reversal of the trial court's decision to grant a Rule 12b6 motion to dismiss, which dismissed Dr. Zamanian's procedural due process claims against East Jefferson General Hospital District, which is commonly referred to as EJ here. The district court found that Dr. Zamanian was afforded adequate procedural due process, but his decision failed to address the substance of the claims put forth in Dr. Zamanian's complaint, an amended complaint, that although the strictures of due process were afforded, that the ultimate decision was arbitrary and capricious in that it failed to consider all of the evidence that was before it at the time of its ruling. Your Honors know undoubtedly that Rule 12b6 motions are rarely granted. They're disfavored by the court, and that every doubt is resolved in favor of the complainant. The facts are looked in the light most favorable to the complainant at this stage of the proceedings. The court's aware that the touchstone of procedural due process is the protection of the individual from arbitrary action of the government. This court affords the backstop and the protection to ensure that government actors are actually enforcing and providing the due process that the Constitution requires them to provide. I would suggest, and I think I made the analogy in the reply brief, that this is essentially looking at an umpire in baseball who's calling balls and strikes, or perhaps a gymnastics or an ice skating judge, and they're making their rulings. Everyone is presumed that they're doing that based on an agreed upon strike zone or criteria that are being adjudged. If for some reason that umpire has his own strike zone that's never communicated to the players, that's improper. That's unfair. And essentially that's what we're arguing happened here, is that East Jefferson had its processes, but they failed to follow them. They didn't look at the evidence and apply them to their procedures. There's two cases out of this court that I think that have been briefed. The first is LaHaye, I believe is how it's pronounced, LaHaye versus Thompson Services Hospital, and then Davis versus West Community Hospital, that provides that hospital staffing decisions require the following to provide minimal due process for staffing decisions. The first is that the procedures of the hospital must be fair. The next is that the standards by the hospital must be reasonable. And the third, which is what we've addressed here, what we're complaining about here, is that the hospital must not act in an arbitrary or capricious manner. What is on appeal here is the decision of EJ to summarily suspend Dr. Zamanian. And the bylaws which govern his relationship with the hospital are very clear what governs a summary suspension. And I'll just read it directly. It says that a summary suspension is only provided when immediate action is required to protect the life or well-being of a patient, or to reduce a substantial and imminent likelihood of significant impairment of life, health, safety of a patient or person. So a summary suspension, the chief of staff can say, hey, you're suspended, leave the premises, we'll deal with this later, but somebody's gonna get hurt. And that's what happened here on October 6, 2013. This is over 5 years ago, this has dragged on. But what happened is it was a Saturday morning, a patient, Dr. Zamanian is a cardiologist. He treats patients throughout the metropolitan area. There was a man that was in the LaPlace area who went to the hospital there. They believed he was having a cardiac arrest, called EJ and asked and Dr. Zamanian if he could be transferred to the East Jefferson General Hospital. Dr. Zamanian was not in the hospital that morning. He gave permission for the transfer. The patient arrived at the hospital. The attending physician in the ER called Dr. Zamanian and said, if we're going to need to do an interventional procedure, how would you like to handle this? Dr. Zamanian said, I have backup physician to assist me since I'm not there is Dr. Rolfson.
Wait. And again, we need to stick strictly to what is pled in your multi-fact based amended complaint.
Certainly.
But as I understood it, Dr. Zamanian could not do whatever procedure, was not permitted to do whatever procedure was being suggested at that hospital.
That
he did not have privileges to do that.
He did not have.
Well, you've just told us something different.
Well, I apologize, Your Honor. There was asked if the procedure was required, then who was to do it?
Right.
Dr. Zamanian had admitting privileges, so he could admit a client to the hospital. If, in fact, the interventional procedure was required, he had a physician lined up to back him up. And I apologize, you're correct, Your Honor. I did misstate that.
Well, when you say back him up, you're suggesting the plaintiff could have done the procedure, but I just wanted you to stick to the complaint.
Well, you're right. He could not, there's no dispute, he was not allowed to do interventional procedures at that time. And he had to have someone there to do them, and that's who Dr. Rolfson was. Per the conversation with the attending in the ER, Dr. Rolfson was called. And Dr. Rolfson asked the ER physician to have Dr. Zamanian call him. And for whatever reason, that was never communicated to Dr. Zamanian. And so what happens in those situations is the own staff cardiologist, the one who's there in the ER, would see the patient and provide any interventional procedures that are necessary. But for reasons related outside of this issue, that own staff cardiologist refused to see this patient because his practice had a policy that they would not see Dr. Zamanian's patients. None of this was ever communicated to Dr. Zamanian. At some point, he finally did learn that that Dr. Rawson had not shown up, and Dr. Zamanian headed immediately to the hospital. And just so it's clear, I don't know that the patient never needed the interventional procedure and survived, and there was no issues with the treatment that was provided that day. So whenever Dr. Zamanian found out that his patient had not been seen by the own staff cardiologist, which is against procedures, he was understandably upset. And he reached out to the chief of staff to ask, why is my patient not being seen by the own staff cardiologist? This was a Saturday morning. The chief of staff was out of the hospital as well. And I think there was some misunderstandings, quite frankly. He interpreted Dr. Zamanian's complaint to be that Dr. Zamanian was asking the chief of staff to order that own staff cardiologist to treat his patient. But that's not what Dr. Zamanian was asking. He was already in the hospital at that time and seeing his patient. And so what happened was the chief of staff did, in fact, order the own staff cardiologist to treat this individual who had been moved to the critical care unit at this point. And there began to be further confusion because Dr. Zamanian was there treating his patient, and he was giving orders to the staff. And then the own staff cardiologist was also treating the patient as he had been ordered to do by the chief of staff without any knowledge from Dr. Zamanian because he had never requested that. So the staff in the hospital, the nursing staff, reaches out to the chief of staff saying, hey, we're getting conflicting information. What am I supposed to do this? What are we supposed to do? The chief of staff, who had interpreted Dr. Zamanian's complaints about the cardiologist, gets frustrated with Dr. Zamanian. What is he doing? He was asking me to order the cardiologist to do this treatment, and now he's here. So he tells this nurse that he's going to summarily suspend Dr. Zamanian and for them not to take his orders. But the chief of staff never communicates this to Dr. Zamanian. So over the course of that day, the chief of staff does come into the hospital. He orders that Dr. Zamanian is suspended, but he sends a sheriff's deputy to go pull Dr. Zamanian away, physically pull him away from meeting with the client's family or the patient's family, and they go into the conference room where he informs them that he's summarily suspended and tells them that if he comes back on the premises, he's going to be arrested. So Dr. Zamanian leaves. There's no real discussion about trying to clear up that confusion that day. And there's no dispute that what happens after that summary suspension, that it goes before the medical executive committee. They affirm the summary suspension. Then it goes before the medical appropriateness standard of care committee. They also approved the summary suspension. It goes in front of the peer review or fair panel process, three full hearings, or it was evenings with other physicians, that the fair review or the fair panel process upheld the summary suspension. And then Dr. Zamanian also filed an appeal with the board of directors, which also affirmed the summary suspension. At the end of the day, we have a decision from the fair panel hearing that's upholding the summary suspension. But the problem begins is that the panel states in its written opinion that this matter can be distilled to the following three issues. One, whether Dr. Zamanian's response was appropriate at the time of patient arrival. Two, whether Dr. Zamanian was disruptive in the emergency room. And three, whether Dr. Zamanian was disruptive in the critical care unit. And I think given that this is a 12B6 motion to dismiss, that all allegations pled must be considered in the light most favorable to the complainant and resolved in his favor, I think it's plain, and this is what is outlined in our amending complaint beginning in the record, I believe it's 65, but these allegations are specified in 72 of the record. This is plainly contradicts the standard for summary suspension that's included in the bylaws. In the course of the discovery that was conducted in advance of the peer review hearings, it was admitted by members of the medical, the MEC, the first review. They didn't review any medical records. They didn't have Dr. Zamanian's side of things. They didn't even look at what the standard as to what they were looking at applied. The same cursory review with the MASOC, and the same with the fair panel. So what we're complaining about here is that the decision to uphold the summary suspension, in order to be to afford due process and not be arbitrary or capricious, it has to be supported by the evidence that was presented to the panel. And we outline a multitude of issues that supports plainly that the decision was arbitrary and capricious and not supported by the evidence that was produced not only by Dr. Zamanian, but by the hospital itself. They say that one of the reasons that Dr. Zamanian for upholding the summary suspension was that the chief of staff informed Dr. Zamanian of the transfer of care to the on-call cardiologist when that first phone call was made. That was never done. The chief of staff himself admitted that at the fair review hearing, that was never done. They uphold the decision that the chief of staff was correct to summarily suspend Dr. Zamanian because he was being disruptive in the ER and the CCH. But the chief of staff's testimony at the fair panel hearing was that he was unaware of any disruptive behavior. So how can you uphold it? They suggest that Dr. Z wanted an emergency angiogram for this patient and that was improper. But the record shows that Dr. Z did not think he needed an emergency angiogram. They suggest that Dr. Z abandoned his patient when he arrived at the hospital. The facts, certainly as alleged in the complaint, make clear that he spoke to the treating physician in the ER and had a plan of care for the patient to be attended to. As soon as he heard that discussion was not followed through, he was immediately at the hospital. The evidence does not support the decision that he abandoned his patient. The fair panel review completely disregarded the entirety of Dr. Zamanian's testimony. They say they disregard it for no reason. He wrote two letters to the panel and to the chief of staff. His testimony was corroborated with what those previous letters had. And the same thing with the patient's son, the one person who would have been an impartial observer to the dispute going on in the hospital. And they discount his testimony because it was emotional and it happened, I think, 18 months before. But he himself had given an affidavit, and there's nothing to suggest that his testimony was unreliable. In In short, the hospital failed to apply the correct standard. It did not afford procedural due process to Dr. Zamanian, and for that reason, we say that the trial court was in error when it granted the Rule 12b6 motion. We ask this court to vacate.
All right, thank you, Mr. Robert. You've saved time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Stecklum.
Good morning, Your Honor. P.J. Stecklum on behalf of East Jefferson General Hospital. At page one of his reply brief, Dr. Zamanian states, quote, there is no dispute that East Jefferson General Hospital, parentheses, EJ in quotes, afforded Dr. Zamanian the appearance of due process, end quote. This is a clear admission that the procedures that were spelled out in the hospital's bylaws satisfied the constitutional requirements for due process.
That's not what he said. He said the appearance of due process. He didn't say that they provided process that might have appeared to be appropriate, but really wasn't. That's what that sentence says.
Yeah, what they can see.
You shouldn't.
I'm not going to waste time on that, Judge.
That's right.
What they're really arguing about is arbitrary.
Excuse me. You've already wasted a minute on it. It's a ridiculous point. Move to something that's substantive.
All right. What he's talking about is arbitrary and capricious. There's two hurdles he's got to overcome when he goes down that path. The first hurdle he's got to overcome is he's got to overcome the presumption that the decision makers acted honestly and with integrity. He doesn't do that in this case. The best he can do is an allegation in the complaint that the decision makers were employed at EJ. But in the Kane v. Hardy case, which was, a 1991 decision en banc by this court, in which all but two judges of this court agreed with the majority opinion, the court basically said that it doesn't work like that. The court said in the Kane case, the state has no constitutional duty to provide a procedural regimen that guarantees faultless decision making. The state's interest in safety and efficiency find expression in that tolerable level of risk. And just as Dr. Kane contended that he was a victim of partisan decision making because his business competitors were part of this decision making process, that's all Dr. Zamanian is contending here, that doctors employed by the hospital were deciding the case against him.
What do you do with the argument that on a Rule 12b-6 dismissal that all of the facts are to be construed in the light favorable to Dr.
Well, I think under 12b-6, you're right. All of the facts do have to be considered. Obviously, under Ashcroft v. Iqbal and Twombly, you get rid of the conclusory allegations, the legal inferences and stuff like that. But when they say all of the factual allegations have to be considered, it means just that. All of the factual allegations have to be considered. And while the complaint does have to be construed liberally in favor of the plaintiff, the court's required to consider all factual allegations, including those that cut against the plaintiff. There was a case that's cited in the brief, and the name escapes me at the moment, but what happened was the plaintiff pled facts. He lost on 12b-6 because the facts he pled him into a statute of limitations issue. Court said he pled those facts. The statute of limitations defense was apparent on the face of the complaint. He loses. In this case, one of the big problems that Dr. Zamanian has is that he pled facts that basically provide a basis for the decision against him. When you get into the terms arbitrary and capricious, there's a lot of cases that define them. Reed versus State Farm is a Louisiana Supreme Court case, which said an arbitrary act is an act based on random choice or personal whim rather than any reason or system, and that court was quoting the New Oxford Dictionary. That court said capricious action is given to sudden and unaccountable changes of behavior. The court also quoted Black's Law Dictionary, where it said a judicial decision founded on prejudice or preference rather than on reason or fact is often termed arbitrary and capricious. In this case, in this court, there was a case last year, Baylor County Hospital District versus Price. Was decided in 2017. It was in the context of an agency rulemaking decision. What had happened there was a Texas hospital was challenging a rule that was promulgated in a Medicare manual, and the question was whether or not this hospital qualified as a critical care hospital for special Medicare reimbursement under the rural reimbursement program. And the issue was the CMS's definition of primary and secondary roads reasonable or not? And what the court, the plaintiff object, the hospital was objecting to it, saying it was, arbitrary and capricious and all that stuff. But this court said, quote, so long as the agency's reasons and policy choices conform to minimal standards of rationality, then its actions are reasonable and must be upheld. And so, in addition to dealing with the honesty and integrity presumption, the plaintiff has the burden to show that the decision that he's questioning before this court does not conform to minimal standards of rationality. And when you get into his case, he makes a number of admissions in his lawsuit that come back and haunt him. For example, in paragraph 12, he alleges that on February 16, 2011, however, EJ revoked Dr. Zamanian's privileges to perform cardiac interventional privileges. Shows he's had a prior issue dealing with loss of privileges. Paragraph 14, Dr. Zamanian is a strong-willed and principled physician who has not hesitated to question administrative practices and procedures when warranted. And again, shows he's had prior conflicts. Paragraph 15 and 16, as a result, he's had conflicts with hospital administrations throughout his career, which has resulted in the wrongful loss of his privileges. And at the time of, in 16, at the time of the incident that eventually resulted in this litigation, Dr. Zamanian was challenging the suspension of his interventional privileges. Again, he's got a history. Paragraph 17, he alleges the incident occurred on October the 6th. The calendar will show that was a Sunday morning, and it extended into Sunday afternoon. He admits in paragraph 27 that he was upset when he arrived at the hospital. Paragraph 31, he admits that after reviewing, paragraph 31 states, after reviewing the results of tests ordered by the emergency room doctor and ordering additional tests of his own, Dr. Zamanian contacted the EJGH's chief of staff and complained about the on-call cardiologist's refusal to see his patient. This was Dr. Zamanian escalating this incident to the chief of staff on a Sunday. Obviously, the chief of staff was not at the office, not at the hospital, as he later alleges in the complaint. Paragraph 32, that communication resulted in a series of miscommunications and misunderstandings that directly resulted in plaintiff's hospital privileges at EJ being unjustifiably and summarily suspended. This is an admission that the plaintiff's actions in escalating the incident to the chief of staff led to the confusion that he later alleges occurred that afternoon. Paragraph 35, due to the chief of staff's order, both Dr. Zamanian and the on-call cardiologist were attempting to treat the patient at the same time. And this is the crux of the problem. We got two doctors trying to treat a patient who's critically ill. He was admitted to the hospital having possibly suffered a heart attack. Paragraph 36, disagreements about the immediate course of treatment ensued. The gist of that is pretty plain. Paragraph 37, Dr. Zamanian was upset with the was upset that the on-call doctor who had previously refused to see the patient just because he was plaintiff's patient was now assuming care while Dr. Zamanian was still the attending physician for the plaintiff. And in paragraph 38, Dr. Zamanian's frustration was exacerbated by the fact that the chief of staff did not inform him until much later in the day that he had ordered the on-call cardiologist to take over care of the patient and that Dr. Zamanian was to step down. Again, admissions that Dr. Zamanian was upset and frustrated. Paragraph 41, with both cardiologists, the on-call cardiologist and Dr. Zamanian, now believing that each was in charge of the patient's care, confusion ensued in the CCU. CCU is the cardiac care unit. Again, you can't have confusion in an area that treats critically ill patients. Paragraph 42, both doctors gave orders to the CCU nurses at the same time. You begin to see what the problem is. Paragraph 43, the situation led to the chief of staff, who was home at the time, being called to come to the hospital. The tension level's getting high. Paragraph 45, the, quote, house representative, unquote, advised the CCU nurses that they were not to take any further orders from Dr. Zamanian per order of Mrs. Brown, the COO, that's chief operating officer, of the hospital. Again, this shows the degree to which the problem has escalated, and, you know, that the house representative is now having to deal with a lot of confusion and tension in the CCU. Paragraph 46, thereafter, the nurses thereafter refused Dr. Zamanian's subsequent orders. Shows Dr. Zamanian is continuing to give orders in spite of the conflicting orders going out. Paragraph 48, Dr. Zamanian sought out the chief of staff for an explanation. Again, he's escalating it back up to the chief of staff. Paragraph 49, thereafter, there were several meetings between the chief of staff and Dr. Zamanian. Obviously, one meeting wasn't good enough. But one of the things that this court is allowed to do under Twombly and Iqbal.
You're spending a lot of time on arguing the merits of the ultimate decision, but you're not saying very much about the due process issue, that is, whether Dr. Zamanian was afforded the due process that the law requires. I mean, it's fine that you argue with us. But tell us about what process was or was not provided as required by law.
Well, the process he received was, once he was notified of his summary suspension, the following day he was given a letter which laid out the grounds for his suspension. That's in his complaint. He doesn't specify what the letter said. He was invited to attend a meeting of the Medical Executive Committee, the MEC, the following day, the 8th of October. He didn't show up for that. He claims in his complaint that it was because he was afraid of a fear of arrest, but there's no allegation in the complaint that he did anything to allay that fear. He didn't call the hospital and say, well, can I really come in, or am I going to be arrested if I come in, or can we do this by phone? None of that happened. The MEC, which he complains about, heard from the on-call cardiologist and the chief of staff. That's in his complaint. So they heard from two eyewitnesses to the incident. He complains that they didn't look at the medical records, but there's no requirement that they look at the medical records. These people are trying to determine what happened, and they heard from two eyewitnesses whose stories were consistent. No need to look at medical records. 2 days after that, the Medical Staff Appropriateness of Care Committee met and considered it again. Dr. Zamanian was a no-show for that. They affirmed the suspension. And then Dr. Zamanian appealed it to the Fair Hearing Panel. This is a panel of five physicians. He alleges they were all employees of EJ. That was not true. There was a cardiologist brought in from another hospital so that we wouldn't have this conflict, but today we're here on the allegation.
But again, we've got to stay within.
You're right. We're here on the complaint.
Please, okay. You know, if you would just let us ask our question and you'd wait to answer, this would proceed a little more smoothly. But we've got to stick within the four corners of the amended complaint.
Correct.
And I've looked at all of it. Where in the amended complaint does it say that a fifth member of the panel was brought in from outside?
It doesn't.
It does not.
I will pass on that. I mentioned we have to assume that they were all EJ employees for
right.
Purposes of today. The panel met on three nights and heard testimony. Prior to the panel meeting, Dr. Zamanian was allowed to conduct discovery. He complains that We didn't follow the bylaws, which provide that the hearing will be held in 45 days. He admits that part of the delay was due to his desire to take depositions, which he was permitted to do. He also obtained documents from the hospital. He also objected. He claims that there, in his complaint, he alleges there were problems in assembling the panel. What he doesn't tell you is that's when he was challenging a couple of members on the panel, and so they were replaced. The panel went ahead and heard the case. He was allowed to submit briefs before and after. He was represented by counsel, had the opportunity to cross-examine witnesses and put on his own witnesses. And at the end of the day, he's objecting to some of the conclusions that the panel reached. But, I mean, anytime you try a case, you're going to get witnesses whose testimony conflicts. The courts, you know, this is a hospital privileges case, a credentialing case, and the courts grant considerable deference to the hospital bodies that make the credentialing decisions because they have a unique expertise in this area. And this case is really classic for that because we had a seriously ill patient. We had a very bad situation in the critical care unit, and we had, you know, we had witnesses who then testified to a panel of doctors about what happened. And, you know, what he's really coming in now and saying is, I want to weigh the evidence. I disagree with the conclusions they reached. But again, we go back to the Kane case, if there's any minimal standard of rationality to support the decision. And in this case, you know, as Judge Zaney found, he received adequate due process. His only complaint on the due process is that the decision they reached was arbitrary and capricious. And his definition of arbitrary and capricious is it disagreed with the evidence he wants to cite. But, you know, he never gets over that last hurdle about proving that there was no minimal standard of rationality behind the decision. And clearly, when you look at what he admits to in his complaint, the situation he created at the hospital that afternoon, the conflicting orders, the fact that he continued to give orders throughout the afternoon after he had several meetings with the chief of staff. And, you know, when we get to the inferences, what is a reasonable inference to draw from his several meetings with the chief of staff? Shouldn't he have asked, don't you think it was reasonable to infer that during at least one of these meetings with the chief of staff, he asked, why is the on-call cardiologist treating my patient? Is it reasonable to infer that he asked, why are they ignoring my orders? Yet after he has this discussion with the chief of staff, he's in there continuing to give orders. And that, Your Honor, is the gist of the problem. He admits in his complaint to enough facts that there's a more than reasonable basis for the decision that the fair hearing panel reached. Now, he does complain about not being able to go to the MEC. I would suggest to the court that the decision by the MEC, the Medical Executive Committee, and the decision by the MSAOC, the Medical Staff at Appropriateness of Care Committee, all became moot once he goes to that full hearing with the panel, because it was a fresh start for him at that point. He had depositions, he had witnesses, he had an attorney, he had briefs, he had everything he needed. So anything that happened earlier, I think, was mooted by the time we get to the fair hearing panel. I think this, you know, that's pretty much where my argument is, Judge.
All right, thank you, Mr. Stakelin. Mr. Robert, you saved time for rebuttal.
Very briefly, Your Honors, I know this is the last day of a long week.
You don't need that. That doesn't need to concern you, Mr. Robert. We're here for you.
I appreciate that.
I know neither side wanted argument, and we think you need argument.
And certainly, and I very much appreciate the chance to argue my case on behalf of Dr. Zamanian here today. I think that the entirety of Mr. Stakelum's argument is premised on viewing the facts in the light most favorable to his client. That's not the standard that's applicable here today. We're not running away from facts that could be construed to be unfavorable to Dr. Zamanian. They're in there because they provide context as to what happened. The reason that there's due process outlined, or these procedures are outlined in the EJ manual and the bylaws, is because he's absolutely right. This is an emergency room. It's a critical care facility. Things happen quickly, and it's important that the chief of staff can take actions that he thinks are necessary to preserve life of patients and the safety of employees and anyone else there, without question, that he is entitled to do that. But the whole reason that the rest of the process is in place is that in those circumstances, sometimes mistakes are made. And that's the purpose of the fair panel review hearing. We put forth all of the evidence in our complaint that plainly disputes the conclusions that were reached by the panel, and their own opinion cites an inappropriate standard that's contained in the bylaws that governs how they are supposed to rule. For the purposes of this no cause of action, we've met our standard, and I think, Your Honor, it's plain that the trial court just erred. It missed the boat on this for whatever reason. Dr. Zamanian has stated a cause of action for violation of his procedural due process rights, and we ask this court to vacate and remand and allow us to go forward on those claims.
All right, thank you, Mr. Rivera. Your case and all of today's cases are under submission, and the court is in recess.